Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning and welcome to this 4th of July special edition of The Show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody. Today, we're revisiting stories from our series Saguaro Land, where the show took a deep look at the Sonoran Desert, the lushest, hottest desert in the world that also happens to be our home. Coming up, a pastry chef whose desserts are intertwined with the Sonoran Desert, and a tiny bug that's played a critical role in the textile world for hundreds and hundreds of years. But first,
sun and sand, sagebrush and tumbleweed, rolling mountains and giant cactus.
From our armchair seat in the sky, we see Arizona's famous Valley of the Sun at Phoenix. Camelback Mountain is outlined on the horizon.
It is perhaps the most iconic figure of the Sonoran Desert, the saguaro cactus. The great bastions of the Southwest, standing tall and waving boldly in just about every image of the American West for decades. But just how far back does this imagery go in American history? And how has this one relatively restricted plant species come to bear the burden of so many expectations? William L. Byrd, Jr. has some answers. Byrd is a curator emeritus at the National Museum of American History and author of the book In the Arms of Saguaro's Iconography of the Giant Cactus, released last October. My co-host Lauren Gilger spoke with him about his extensive research into the saguaro and what he found when he dove into it.
When I started this, I thought that, well, there's probably this nice arc ascending, you know, the curve of popularity to where we get down to today, where the saguaro is just this ubiquitous symbol of the West, anything West. And it's more like it's kind of an up and down. I mean, the arc goes up for sure, but it kind of has, you know, two steps forward, one step back. And that has to do with the forces of irrigation that do not want to use any kind of native botany as a symbol for anything.
Interesting.
You know, it's the orange tree, it's the orange grove. It really isn't until you get to the 20s, 30s, where the travel and tourism industry starts to pick up. And it's really the guest ranch owners who gravitate toward this, you know, armed saguaro as a symbol. And it becomes part of the fun in the sun tourism message of, you know, cowboy hats, Western wear, horseback rides, bathing suits, swimming pools, and saguaros. You know, what could be better?
What could be better? Yeah. I wonder, like, if there is any evidence in the research, right, of the reaction of the rest of the country when they start to see these. Like, what was it about the saguaro that started to draw people west, and why would they want to use it in the tourism stuff? Like, is it just like a novelty? People had never seen anything like this before?
Yes, I think that's it. I mean, as soon as the railroad comes to Tucson in 1880, and we can date this pretty accurately, you know, the railroad comes from California. It's working its way east. So the first things that make the return trip are transplanted columnar saguaros that get planted, transplanted on the Pacific coast in what are known or become known as Arizona gardens. And they're sort of monuments to conspicuous, you know, I don't know, transplantation in the garden of the Hotel Del Monte, which is created to draw Southern Pacific passengers to the Carmel area. And they have, you know, these massive columnar saguaros that are able to be transported there by the railroad. And they never last. They don't last. I mean, you can look at successive pictures of the garden and, you know, in a matter of years, the saguaros just kind of fade away and you're left with palms and agaves and that kind of thing. But they also begin to go east. They travel east along Southern Pacific stations along the way. There's a cactus garden in Los Angeles. There's a massive saguaro that's trackside in San Antonio. And the most riveting photo that I found was at the Chicago World's Fair, the World Columbian Exposition, 1893. This is the Great White City, Daniel Burnham. There's an armed saguaro outside the horticulture pavilion with a selection of, a linear kind of a sand pile of barrels and agaves and columnar saguaros. Wow. And people in bowler hats are walking by it, looking at it. It's really quite stunning.
You said that you went to grad school in Tucson a long time ago, and it sounds like you've been collecting images like this for a very long time. Tell us your own interest in this.
Well, I just basically parachuted in here to Arizona in the mid-70s, and I had not spent any time in southern Arizona. I've done all the Grand Canyon things and wonderful things up north, and I was just stunned that you could just that it was also accessible here. What's now, Saguaro West, and of course mm-hmm. there was Saguaro East, the national parks, bracketing both ends of the city, were just like stunning to, a flatlander from Maryland like me. And I just never quite got over, how wonderful and how accessible it was. And when I left and went back to DC to try and break into the museum world where I'm from, I would once in a while would run into tourism literature. I mean, some of it's quite early, from the 1950s. And I would just pick it up and kind of wonder at it, look at it, and just, I would just look at it out of kind of nostalgia, really. Hmm. And didn't really think that much about it, And then when after I retired, I thought, I really should do something with this because it's probably a big part, has a part in, why I'm wanting to still go out there, be here, mm-hmm. Where, of course, I am now. And there was one magazine in particular that really recommended itself to me. It was a black and white monochrome magazine that simply said Arizona across the top of the cover. And it wasn't Arizona Highways. It wasn't anything like that. Right. I'd seen all that.
Yeah.
This is a black and white image. It's of a woman, a model wearing a sawtooth pocket Western wear shirt. She's got the white cowboy hat on. But her arms are folded and she's leaning on the arm of a saguaro. Hmm. And you look at this and you're going like, wait a minute, there's supposed to be some spines there. How can you get that close? She's literally in the arms of a saguaro, mm-hmm. hence the title of the book. And that's kind of where it starts out with this woman just kind of blithely, pleasantly relaxing in the arms of a saguaro.
Yeah.
And that's something that the travel and tourism industry created as a kind of a viral, publicity. They didn't use that word, but that was the intent. They would publish these photos and send them out, syndicate them, and in the hopes that they would recommend themselves to the nation's editors and, publishers. And it basically worked. And so you have people, models, pose, sitting, standing, leaning, barefoot. Sometimes on the arms of a saguaro that's been carefully, worked so that they can actually do that. Or sometimes they're sitting on it and you can detect that there maybe is a kind of a pad under it, but I didn't realize when I saw that magazine cover that was a thing. That was a kind of a conscious policy that they would promote, Southern Arizona with these, what they called gag photos.
I want to end with a big picture question, of course, because the saguaro is so linked today with the iconography of the West, of Arizona, of this part of the world that we live in, and you've really kind of looked at the history of that. I wonder if there's if you have any reflections on why that is, like why we are so entranced by this giant cactus. Like, what is it that kind of beckons us or calls us?
Well, one of the things that I noticed, I mean, I've looked at every saguaro photo that you can, I tried to find. And a lot of times, and this is irregardless of the time period, you see people gingerly poking the spines on the plant. And it's like, you're reaching out, touching the plant. And so I published this book. A lot of people are posing, sitting around, touching, the plant. Mm. But in the end, what it's really about is like, hey, these plants, they touch us.
Mm.
And I think that's what it means. And that's what I hope it comes down to in the end. Yeah. There's something about these plants. They touch us.
That is William L. Byrd Jr., the author of the new book, In the Arms of Saguaros, The Iconography of the Giant Cactus. He is also curator emeritus at the National Museum of American History joining us. Larry, thank you so much for coming on and talking about this and all of the research here. It's really interesting stuff. Thank you.
My pleasure, Lauren. Thanks.
Many people see the Sonoran Desert as a harsh environment that can be dangerous, and it certainly can be, but it can also heal and nourish. Felicia Ruiz is a curandera, or traditional healer, as well as an author and teacher. Last summer, I spoke with her about the healing properties of the Sonoran Desert.
We live in one of the most edible and medicinal environments in the world here in the Sonoran Desert, so lots of foods that we can grow or forage, as well as foods that we can use for medicine.
What are some of the ones that you find yourself using or talking about most often?
I do my best to share on foods that people have access to. And with so many people moving to Phoenix from other parts of the country, a lot of people don't know what our edible landscape is. And so I'll tell them, just go look outside, look for the Palo Verde trees, look for the mesquite trees. They both have edible fruits. And, you know, the mesquite alone, it's the tree of life for a reason, because we have so many things that we can make from that tree.
So you can eat flowers from the Palo Verde trees?
Yes, they kind of taste like sunflower seeds to me. So when they are in full bloom, and I know a lot of people don't like when they are just all over the driveway.
The yellow flowers, yes, that you can't get rid of.
Yes, go collect them. And next time you make a green salad, just toss some in there. They do taste like sunflower seeds. And I often dry those as well and use them to make like a herbal tea infusion.
I want to ask you about bougainvillea water. And I know that bougainvillea is not necessarily native to the Sonoran Desert, but so many people have it in their yards or have it nearby. And I had never heard of it until somebody brought it up to me, but apparently it's something that's very popular.
Yes, I would say, at least in my culture, on my Mexican side, it's something that many of us grew up drinking as a herbal infusion for like coughs, like respiratory lung issues. It's vibrant, it's pink, you know, especially bougainvillea comes in so many different colors, but the ones that most of us see around here in the valley are the bright pink fuchsia flowers. But you're actually using the bracts, they're not the flowers, but it is that brightly colored petal leaf. Bract. And what we'll do is we'll just gather a whole bunch of those. We'll put them in a pot of water and really boil them, at least for our family, about 10 minutes. And then we just let them sit and cool down. Add some honey. Sometimes I'll put a cinnamon stick in there and add some lime or lemon. It's super refreshing. And when my daughter was little, I used to call it hummingbird water.
Now, does it taste kind of like, I'm imagining, like an herbal tea kind of thing based on how you're describing it?
A little bit. Some people think it almost looks and tastes like jamaica, hibiscus tea, but I don't think it tastes that strong. It's actually very delicately flavored.
When you talk about the ability to forage in the Sonoran Desert and all sorts of different plants that have medicinal qualities to them, they might taste good to some people. How many of those things have been sort of known for generations and generations, and how many of them are maybe being discovered now?
Well, I wouldn't use the word discovered, because I feel like they are just plants that we've used since time has begun. But I would say a lot of us are remembering the plants that our elders used, or our community, our culture. I don't really think that they've been forgotten, where we're like rediscovering them, but I do hear from my own community that many of the elders are really excited to see the younger generation going out and using them again in a way that they remembered them being used.
Do you find that there are younger people who are really interested in this and trying to sort of reconnect with their roots, especially in indigenous communities?
Most definitely. With so many of our indigenous families like now living in urban areas, you know, we live in areas where you don't have an acre of desert and you can just go out and forage. So there are a lot of programs that are in motion now where we can take people out to the desert and forage and help them reconnect to their culture through food. I really see it in their eyes. Like, they're really excited because I think it's for them, they feel like they're anchoring themselves in stories that they've heard in the past from family members, and it's somehow giving them the context that they've only heard about or read about. But when you can make something, touch it, feel it, cook it, collect it, smell it, it just really brings it to life.
What do you think it is about the Sonoran Desert that makes it a place where so many of these kinds of plants grow?
I don't know if I can answer that. I feel really blessed to have been born and raised on this land and that my people have been here for a long time. I don't know. Perhaps we were just lucky to have this, what people think is a wasteland. You know, they look at the brown desert. They don't see the life that I see.
Do you find yourself sticking to uses of some of these plants and flowers that have been used for generations? I mean, do you maybe try to take something and use it maybe in a different way or find a different use for it?
Yes, I absolutely love cooking with flowers. And so, for instance, long ago, we weren't adding ice to our beverages and things like that. And yet I will get the flowers, let's say, from ironwood tree or flowers from the Palo Verde tree. And sometimes I will put those in my ice cube trays, like the old school ice cube trays, and then freeze those. And just even having that little nod to the desert in my ice cube is kind of fun for the summer beverages, even though, of course, that's not a traditional thing to do, but it's so pretty.
Do you think that you see the Sonoran Desert a little differently maybe than other people, given what you know about which plants and flowers and fruits can be eaten and what the stories are and the traditions are behind them?
I do. Growing up, I didn't really have the same relationship that I do now, but definitely apprenticing and learning under many of the indigenous grandmothers of our desert, they really have helped me I guess give more context to what it means like to be a desert person, to be a desert dweller, and to work with the land and to really know that we're part of nature and not apart from it.
And I would imagine there's a significance also to it not just being an edible landscape, but having some of these things that have medicinal quality too, that have healing qualities to them.
Oh, yeah. So many of our plants are actually used as medicine. And just as an example that I like to share when I'm taking people on walks is the prickly pear pad, the nopal. If you have ever burned yourself, many of our grandmas will say to put aloe vera, you know, and we can also do the same for our skin for that burn with a filleted cactus pad.
Huh.
So it has that same slimy, mucilaginous kind of cold and cool gel that can also be used on your skin for burns. So that's medicine.
All right. Felicia, thanks a lot for coming in. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Felicia Ruiz is a curandera or traditional healer, as well as an author and teacher. Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, connecting the desert with dessert. A local pastry chef talks about her culinary craft in the desert. But first, if you have paddle cactus in your yard like prickly pear, you may have noticed a white, almost web-like substance on the surface. But what you can't notice, at least just by looking, is that the web conceals a type of bug that's played a critical role in the textile world for a long, long time. Cochineal has been a source of red dye for thousands of years and is still used today. Last August, I sat down with Erica Lynn Hansen, an associate professor of textiles and socially engaged practices at ASU, to get a sense of the insect's history and role in our ecosystem. Professor Hansen also brought some show and tell along as well.
So cochineal is a beetle-like parasite that lives on prickly pear cactuses here in the Sonoran Desert, and also through Central and Southern America.
And they are white when you look at them, right?
The bug themselves is actually like a purplish, a dark purplish color. The white on the outside that we're seeing is the webbing that holds the insect to the paddle cactus. So it's like sort of a protective webbing.
Okay. And my understanding is all you need to do to create something totally different is just take one in your hand and like squeeze it between two fingers. Is that right?
Kind of. So if you were going to be using cushion eel for a dye, you would dry out the bug after being removed from the cactus. And once it's dry, you actually remove that white webbing, and then it's crushed up and boiled and ground and then turned into a dye.
How was it discovered that you could use these bugs to create dye?
I mean, it's been historically used in the Americas for centuries. So, like, thinking about natural dyes or organic dyes, however you want to classify them, there's sort of a whole, like, practice of using dyes found in nature pre-industrially all over the world. So we can like have an understanding of sort of the local ecology of a place through the dyes that have been historically used there. And so that's what I think is really cool about cochineal, is it's like one of the colors that is like inherent in this place.
And how has it been used throughout history? Like, has it sort of been used for the same kinds of things over time?
Yeah, I mean, the short of it is it was historically used as a dye for garments, specifically like thinking about special garments, because the size of the dye and the amount of dye that's extracted from the bug, it takes a lot of the substance to dye a thing. So if we think about like the best like analog we have to that is sort of the way that we understand, like if you remember like learning about colors as a kid, mm-hmm. thinking about purple as like a color that was thought of and associated with royalty,
yeah,
that comes from the fact that historically, before pre-industrialized dyes happened, purple was extracted from a small shellfish. So you would take, it would take mounds of this shellfish to create enough dye to make a garment. So thinking about the idea of labor and like weight of thing and sort of like amount of thing that had to be collected to create that object. So cochineal existed kind of similarly. So thinking about, in terms of like what was sort of the access to this red dye. So being used for like very specific, like special, like ceremonial garments, then also just like ways to color and pigment the world.
How prevalent are these bugs? Like you say, it takes a lot to make the dye. Like, are there a lot of these bugs on prickly pears around the Sonoran Desert?
Yeah. So when we think about them in terms of like their presence in the Sonoran Desert, like prickly pears are interesting to think about in terms of like any sort of plant or animal in terms of like wild versus cultivated. So there are farms still that exist in Mexico and Peru, elsewhere in Central and South America, that specifically are, they're there to farm cochineal. So they have specific paddle cactuses that are like, there's a whole process involved. Like if we think about any sort of farming practice. So that's how cochineal is used on an industrial scale, still small scale because it's a cactus. It's growing these small bugs, but like in the Sonoran Desert, in your backyard, you will probably see this like white fuzz on your paddle cactus. And so for us, it's a pest, right? So if left like to its own devices, it's a parasite on that cactus and it will like end up suffocating it. So a lot of people here, when they sort of interact with cochineal, it's sort of in a pest removal strategy as opposed to thinking about it as sort of the most important way to color something red.
That's really interesting that it has this great use, but if you don't use it for that, it can really be damaging to the plant.
Yeah.
So you mentioned that there are still farms in parts of Central and South America where they have paddle cactuses to basically not to breed cochineal, but to collect them, to farm them. Yeah. So like, is it still fairly prominent that people use this bug for this kind of dye now?
Yeah, totally. And there's sort of like two avenues that it's used in. I mean, there's kind of constantly been a practice of textile practitioners using natural-based dyes to use it on sort of like small scale, thinking about like handmade goods, artists. But then also like cochineal has been used in manufacturing of like our everyday goods. And there was sort of like a peak sort of mid-20th century, and then it fell off a little, and now there's sort of a rise in it again. It was used very heavily in cosmetics, in food coloring, and across like whole spectrums of things like that, where there needed to be a safe additive that was red before just using sort of a synthesized color. And there's a resurgence again of using it again. So people trying to not use these like chemically produced colorways, but then using that.
Right. I was going to ask you if it's now seen as sort of a kind of a cool, maybe retro, natural kind of way to dye, because obviously there are plenty of other ways to make the color red.
Yes. Yeah, 100%. There's like a huge resurgence in people using plant-based dyes and doing research in that. I mean, there's something really interesting about using natural-based dyes in thinking about it as a larger practice. And if you use the dyes that are local to where you live, sort of thinking about what that local palette looks like. And that's one of the things we're really lucky about here is we have this as one of the elements of our natural palette.
So you brought a little bit to demonstrate here. Can we see how this actually works?
Yeah, totally. And I brought some paddle cactuses with the cochineal on them, but I also brought some industrially farmed cochineal so we can just see the size difference.
Great. All right. So we have here before us, we have two paddles. You have a mortar and pestle. And as you said, you brought some other cochineal. So how do you go about trying to remove the bugs from the cactus?
So first of all, because this is demonstration, I usually would not have removed the paddles from the cactus. So usually I would take a paintbrush and just sort of swipe them off, or like a plastic knife and just pull them off.
Okay.
But for demonstration purposes, it's really easy enough just to do it with your fingers. So these have the tiny little spikes, so I'm going to try and be careful not to touch them. But so right here we can see the cochineal and how the webbing is attaching to the cactus itself.
Yeah, it's like a fluffy white, exactly. Almost like a little tiny little fluffy beard.
Yeah, and I'm going to be curious to see how big the bugs are here just because it's been summer and we haven't had a lot of rain. And they feed off the cactus, and a lot of these cactuses have been a little drier. So it's sort of interesting to sort of track the size of the bug, where they're at in their cycle. This cactus I pulled this from is usually covered in them. Very few on there now. So usually when we look at them, I'll just pull this off a little bit and see if we even get any.
Right, so now you're sort of like going through it in your fingers there, this almost like a cotton swab kind
of
thing.
Yeah, it's very cottony. And so we try and just remove this to get to the bug itself.
It looks like there might be something in there.
Yep, there's a little guy.
And that's like a tiny like black speck almost.
Exactly. So it's super small. And if we pull just this up in relationship to one of these. So this cochineal that I just pulled out, it's going to be fleshy and it's going to be wet, essentially, because it was live because I just pulled it off of a cacti. But these ones that we're going to pull out are the dried beetles. So imagine their shrinking that happens in the drying.
Yeah. That's much bigger.
It's much bigger and it's dried out because it's been farmed. It's been like bred for size as we think about all like agricultural practices.
Still very small, but bigger than the one that you just pulled off the pad.
Exactly. So here's a dry one. We'll set that aside. So if we were going to make dye out of this dried one, we take the dried cochineal, put them in the mortar and pestle, grind them up, and you want to do that. But with this little wet guy, we can just look at sort of the way the color instantly leaves it.
Oh, yeah. It's like maroonish color on your finger now.
Exactly. So even though like this is a deeply inefficient practice and you would probably not be doing this is a way to like dial your clothes red by the cacti in your yard, it gives you a different appreciation for the things that like make up your world.
All right, Erica, thanks so much for coming in. I appreciate it.
Yeah, happy to.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. How is dessert done in the desert, specifically the Sonoran Desert? The woman who made Chris Bianco's wedding cake, Chef Tracy Dempsey, knows all about that. Dempsey didn't grow up in the desert. She spent her childhood all over the place. But she and her husband, Chuck, a meteorologist, have lived here for decades. She graduated from culinary school here in 1999, and she's left her mark on the dessert menus of some of the best valley restaurants. My co-host Lauren Gilger spoke with her last September about her culinary craft in the desert.
So tell us, first of all, what are we going to make today?
Today we're going to make chiletepin shortbreads, so it's a little sweet, baked good little cookie.
That's Tracy Dempsey, a longtime pastry chef here in the Valley. She got her start at the original Mountain Shadows and Lawns at the Hermosa Inn, two places deeply grounded in the Sonoran Desert. She went on to work with Bernie Kantak at Cowboy Chow in Old Town Scottsdale, and now she runs a wine and pastry shop in Tempe and has made desserts for high-end locals from Citizen Public House to F&B. And often, she brings the Sonoran Desert, quite literally, into her baking.
Place is very important. Having, whether it's Chipotle, if it's some interesting things like using mesquite beans in a dessert or in some crackers. You know, those are things that people see every day, but they might not think about consuming and that they're edible.
I met Dempsey recently in the back of her Tempe shop to make those chiltepin shortbreads and figure out how to deal with something so spicy in a dessert.
They're actually really spicy. They have quite a bite. They're about 40 times spicier or hotter than a jalapeno. Ooh.
Yeah, okay. Well, so how do you handle that in a baking situation where, I mean, the end product needs to be sweet?
Well, that's where sugar and fat come into play, because fat always helps to neutralize a little bit of spiciness and things. So you think about an ice cream or maybe a chocolate pot au creme that has cayenne and different chilies in it. You get the nuances of the chili, but you don't get all that heat because the fat just kind of takes the edge off, if you will.
Okay, all right. So let's see. We have the standing mixer, lots of yummy-looking ingredients. Where do we begin?
We're going to start by creaming some butter with confectioner's sugar. I mean, you want it to be room temperature so you get it creamed nicely.
And confectioner's sugar, this is like powdered sugar, right?
Exactly, powdered sugar. Yep. And then I'm going to go ahead and pull out one of these chiltepin.
So they almost look like beans, or like little tiny round beans.
They do. And are you catching a whiff of them? Oh, yeah, yeah, they're pretty potent, aren't they?
For you can things. Smell that.
Yeah. I think the Nahual word for them is translated into flea because they're so tiny. But I also think it has to do with the bite, because they are, for little tiny peppers, they are so hot. And the heat is really fleeting. It's really interesting because we'll make a salsa at home with it, just a little bit of vinegar and some salt, and grind them up and puree it. And it's really hot and it's really pleasant to eat, but it's very fleeting. And then you're ready for more. And by the time you're done eating it, you're just sweating. And you feel like it's been a detox situation for your whole body. You feel cleansed afterwards.
That's good. So these are dried.
These are dried, yeah. And these are really, they can be challenging to find because there are ones called chili piquin, mm-hmm. which is more kind of the same size, but it has a point on the end. So it's almost conical. And they get a little, at the market, they might be, the name might be a little interchanged. So you want to make sure you're really using a chiltepin. But these are very challenging to cultivate. They grow in North America in the Southwest and then in northern Mexico. Mm-hmm. And they require, out in the desert Southwest, they require a nurse plant so they can be protected. Mm-hmm. But I've tried growing these numerous times, bought the little tiny seeds, you know, got them moist and tried to get them to germinate. Big fail. It's just nothing.
So that's interesting. So a nurse plant, you mean like it's under a tree or under a bush or something so that it can actually grow? It's too vulnerable otherwise, essentially?
Exactly. So you notice how you see like a lot of little cacti that are growing under a nurse plant. Maybe it's creosote or something of that nature that protects it. And so they need protection.
So what do we do with these?
So we're going to crush them up. I like to use this little chilipitinero. It's a little wooden vessel made out of ironwood, which is also from the desert. And it's a nice way to keep them from coming into too much contact with your hands. I'm a contact lens wearer, so it's really, I don't want to really have too much contact with this, but I'm going to use my left hand because I use my right hand to take out my lenses. But
so even just touching them, like they're that spicy.
They really are. So I'm going to put a couple into the...
This is just like a tiny little like wooden vessel. It looks like a pepper, but I'm supposing that doesn't need to be. But a tiny little slot, you're putting a few in.
Right. Okay. So it's about the same size as the chilies themselves, mm-hmm. right? And you can just put a couple in there. And then you have this little guide to poke them and break them up. I'm kind of grinding.
Oh, yeah. Huh. Oh, it's like a powder.
Yeah.
That was fast.
Yeah, right? So I'm not going to use all of that. I'm going to see the little tiny seeds.
Yeah. So you're kind of tapping the powder into the powdered sugar and butter mix.
Right. Okay. So I'm going to put that on the mixer. And since my butter is nicely at room temperature, it's going to cream pretty quickly.
So tell me, I mean, you've been cooking, or baking, I should say, in Arizona for a very long time and have worked at some of the best restaurants here, some restaurants that are really rooted in the Sonoran Desert. What does that mean to you, like, to try to use those ingredients? When did you start experimenting with this kind of stuff?
I think it was actually probably back when I was working at Lawns, trying to use a little bit more of our native ingredient. And it wasn't until I was at Cowboy Chow that it was really, that was just, it really had a place there. And it was really important to, you know, incorporate not just our native ingredient, but also our local ingredients. I know we had like a Mexican chocolate pot au creme that Chef Bernie Cantac had started, and then I took it over and tweaked it a little bit and used a little bit more like ancho chili and brought things, you know, different, more specific chilies into it. I think it's important because when we're local independent restaurants, for example, or even a local independent bakery wine shop like we are, mm-hmm. it's important to tap into your community and tap into what's local, what represents our, you know, where we are.
And there tends to be a lot of edible ingredients in the desert, like literally in, you know, a mesquite tree growing on the side of the road, or if you go to a park or a preserve, you're going to find a lot of these ingredients just literally on the ground.
It's true, right? And everybody's raking them up or blowing them in the streets. I know. I think that's where there's that disconnect. It's like, it's just, you know, the flora and the fauna around us. And it's like, no, it's really, this is stuff people eat. Mm. And a lot of it's really good for you, like mesquite flour. It's really great. You know, people would eat the actual beans inside. We've roasted them and ground them up to use in ice cream. Oh. But they're also, they were used as a coffee replacement. So you would roast them and then grind them like coffee. And they have almost that same thing that in Louisiana, I remember my great-grandparents drank the chicory coffee. And it has that malty, but it's a great coffee replacement, but it doesn't have the caffeine. Mm. So many things around us that are just, I think we assume that things are toxic, everything. And they're not.
Don't eat that.
It's always what we're told, right? Don't eat that. Don't eat that. You know, that was on the ground. Don't eat that. Mm-hmm. You don't know what that is. But a lot of our plants here are indeed very edible and have multiple uses.
There's something ironic in that, since it's a desert that seems very standoffish in some ways, right?
It sure is. I know. We think it's, you know, people assume that the desert is like it's not alive. We forget how living and full of life it is. I mean, I think anybody who doubts that can go out after a rain and see the cactus doing their thing, because that's their opportunity. You have so many little berries, like there's the shrubs with the little barberries that you can find at some of the Middle Eastern markets here. So we have our butter and powdered sugar creamed to this. We're going to add a little bit of crunchy sea salt.
Flour going in now?
Flour going in, and that's all there is to this. It's just butter, sugar, flour, and whatever you want to add as a flavoring. In this case, we're adding the chili tepen. Yep. Now we can go ahead.
Oh, this looks like beautiful dough now we've got here, yeah. Tracy Dempsey, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Seed libraries are growing in popularity. For a while now, we've been able to go to the Phoenix Public Library and check out seeds, and seed sharing events are popping up all over town. Back in 2020, Danielle Carlock started a seed library for the Maricopa County Community College District with a twist. All of the seeds in her library are native to the Sonoran Desert. Now, you might think that native plants are easier to grow here. Conditions should be prime, right? Turns out that's not always the case. Even Carlock, a seasoned gardener, struggles with some seeds. And since you check out the seeds but don't have to return them like you would a book, no one knows if you had any luck. But last summer, Carlock created a survey to ask gardeners to let her know what kind of luck they had with her seeds. She shared a few preliminary results with my co-host Lauren Gilger, along with other ideas about how to get native plants growing.
The Sonoran Desert is under a lot of pressures. We have drought, we have invasive species, we have development. And so these sorts of pressures, you know, make what we're growing in our own yards and our patios and things like that more and more important, I believe. So I'm really kind of focusing on this idea of urban and suburban restoration, trying to kind of bring back what we used to have in these areas before they were developed.
Danielle Carlock is a librarian at South Mountain Community College. And back in 2020, she did something to help people living in cities and suburbs grow native plants and restore the Sonoran Desert. She created the Native Seed Library, which now has six locations around the Maricopa Community College District.
We're never going to have, you know, a full wild scape really back in these locations, but we can develop like a replica of what was out there. by selectively putting in native plants that were here originally and are still here, but they're out on our hiking trails, they're in our parks and places like that, and they're not really in our human landscapes anymore. But we can start to slowly bring these back.
And the beauty that restoration brings is something she learned gardening in her own yard.
I experienced this in my home when I bought a house that was just kind of bare dirt and weeds. And I slowly, over many years, started adding native plants. And the more native plants I added, the more wildlife. Every year I had different things coming, and it was an amazing and joyful, you know, process. And so that's what I'm trying to engage people in the valley in, is to kind of say, you know, we can support wildlife and we can also find joy in that, because then you'll see things like, you know, different birds coming in to use your space. You know, you might see butterflies lay their eggs and have a butterfly larvae, and then the metamorphosis into butterflies right in your own garden.
Yeah.
And so these are really amazing things that we can engage in and help the Sonoran Desert.
I spoke with her more about the project, how it's grown, and what's happened to the seed packet she's given out so far. And we're talking a lot of seeds.
And we've given out 12,000 seed packets so far.
12,000 seed packets? That's a lot.
I know. Seeds. I don't know where all the seed is going. It's amazing because I'm the primary gatherer of the seed. I personally collect and touch all the seed.
Wow.
So it's a lot of seed.
Wow. Tell us about where you get it all and getting it out to folks.
So it's mostly sourced from the Tonto National Forest. So the seed is mostly wild collected. Mm. And that means I go through a permitting process to get permission to actually collect on the Tonto National Forest. And that's an important piece, is that folks shouldn't go out and collect seed, you know, kind of on their own. It does require, you know, a permitting process. Mm-hmm. I also collect on the campuses. SCC has an amazing garden of native plants that I've been collecting from, and my home garden. I do sometimes take some donations from folks that are, you know, that I trust, that I know that they have what they say they have, and I can verify that, mm-hmm. you know, before I take that in. So I have taken some donations as well, which are always welcome.
Tell us about the plants themselves. Like, what do we mean when we say native plants? Like, I don't even know if I could name one, honestly.
Yeah, sure. You know, we have thousands of native plants. And when I first came out here, I thought that I knew them in the first, you know, couple of months. And, you know, it was those ones that are really iconic, like the saguaro or maybe like a mesquite tree. But the more that I did hiking and going out on the trails and then using the iNaturalist app and then kind of learning from different botanists and people that knew this stuff, I realized that, wow, there's like thousands of native plants. And there are trees, there are shrubs, there are vines, there are ground covers, there are cacti, there are annuals and grasses, so many different types of plants. And these are the plants that have evolved here over, you know, thousands and thousands of years. And they all have interrelationships with each other and with the other living things, you know, in the Sonoran Desert. And it creates a tapestry of life that is really interrelated. And so it's really important to support our native plants, because we can't have an intact Sonoran Desert without those native plants.
Yeah. So yeah. You have given out, you said, 12,000 seed packets. Mm-hmm. And it's been going on for some time now. But you sort of send them off into the world. And then do you wonder what happens to them? Do you know if people are able to grow the seeds?
Yeah, so that's really interesting. So when I founded the seed library, that was one of my biggest worries, is that, you know, I knew it was harder to get native seeds to germinate compared to like your food crops, because food crops have been bred by, you know, by humans for thousands and thousands of years to germinate quickly. And so, you know, you put in some lettuce or something like that, and 7 to 10 days later, you have little seedlings popping up. It's not the same for native plants, because they have sort of built-in mechanisms to make sure they don't germinate when the conditions aren't ideal for them. Otherwise, you know, they have a one chance, you know, they're one and done. If they germinate at the wrong time and there's not enough water or it's too cold or something like that, that's the end of their life. So they have built-in mechanisms to only germinate under ideal conditions. And it's a little bit harder to get those conditions. You know, that's the challenge. And so what we're doing is we're trying to get folks to report back on their experiences with these packets that have gone out. So I've got a survey running right now to ask people their experiences and trying to understand where the successes were, where the failures were, so that we can maybe do some more targeted education and outreach and try to get better germination. Because the one thing I certainly don't want is for folks to get discouraged about native plants because they took some packets and it didn't work for them.
Right, right. I mean, it seems counterintuitive, right? Like, you'd think if it's a native plant, it grows here on its own out in the middle of the desert. Why would it be hard for me to start? But it takes these kind of specific conditions. What have you learned so far from folks in this survey?
Some folks have had success and some haven't. I'm going to dig a little deeper. Some of them have given me permission to follow up with them and do a little interview with them to learn more. When I do know that, like, certain seeds have specific requirements, like some of them need a period of cold before they will germinate. So this will be like your spring wildflowers. They actually need to go through like a cold period in the wintertime. So you typically sow them in October or November or maybe September. So if somebody sowed those seeds like in February, it's too late. Because they have to go through that cold period and then germinate. So that's one example. Or some seeds require what's called stratification, and this would happen naturally. So the seeds, they're subjected to different, you know, pressures down in the soil and in the gravel and things like that, that kind of break open a part of the seed so that water can get in and they will germinate. And if they don't have that, it's called scarification. If you don't have that process, then they won't germinate. So, but you can replicate this if you're going to like start them indoors. You could scratch them with a little file, and that's called stratification. You know, that's mechanical stratification. And then that opens up the seed to allow water to get in. And once they can imbibe water, they can germinate. So if I know that about a seed, I can provide that information on the packet. But we don't always know what seeds need what kind of treatments. And some may not need any treatments, and some don't, for sure. But a lot of it isn't known yet. You know, there hasn't been really controlled trials on a lot of these native species to know what their needs are.
It sounds like you're starting to do that all yourself. Like, you are the base of knowledge for this.
No, there's other people involved. And actually, the Center for Native and Urban Wildlife at Scottsdale is doing a lot of work on that, too, to propagate native plants. But there hasn't been enough of it.
Are people surprised, Danielle, that it's this hard, or that it's this complicated, or that there's this much, I guess, like, science behind it?
Yeah. I mean, I think that when you know the actual requirements of the plant and you carry them through, it's relatively easy. Or if the plant doesn't require any pretreatment, for example, I've got one, Pink Parisia, I just have to sow it and keep it wet. And I sow it indoors, you know, in little trays, and keep them moist, and they'll come up in about 10, maybe 15 days. And so that one's a pretty easy one. And there's other ones like that. But then there's others that are much harder. And some of them need a two processes. Like, they might need a cold period and like some sort of mechanical stratification or something like that.
That's really interesting. So you're continuing to get these seeds out there, and I know that was kind of your main goal from the beginning. What kinds of success stories have you heard? I mean, as you're doing this research and as you're hearing, I'm sure, back from some people who you've given these seeds to, you've experienced, I know, a lot of joy from just bringing this kind of nature, this kind of natural Sonoran landscape into your own yard. Do you think you're able to spread that in this way? Is it working in that sense?
Yeah, you know, I do hear back from some folks. I had someone that wrote me and said, you know, I grew out 100 milkweed plants from the seeds you gave me, and I gave them out for free through my little seed library, plant stand and little seed library. So people got to just take those plants, and that I thought that was amazing. And then I have someone else who took a lot of different seeds and got germination, and she's been really excited about, you know, learning the different plants and seeing the wildlife coming to her yard. So it is working. It's just, every seed that goes out is not going to germinate, because in the wild, that's true too, right? That's why plants, they produce many, 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 many seeds,
yeah,
with only a few of them that will ever maybe germinate and become a full plant themselves. That's just how nature works.
That's just how nature works. All right, we'll leave it there. That is Danielle Carlock, a librarian at South Mountain Community College, who created the Native Seed Library. Danielle, thank you so much for coming back on the show, and best of luck.
Thank you so much.
And that'll do it for this special Thursday, 4th of July edition of the show. Thank you, as always, so much for listening. For Lauren Gilger, I'm Mark Brody. Have a terrific rest of your day. Have a great and safe 4th of July. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow. That's it for this episode of The Show Podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.